for many years, Europe had a quota system, right? A milk quota system. So they were really very profitable at that point. And so they really couldn't increase milk production. Here in the U.S., if we had spare money, if farms were really profitable, we tended to add cows and add cows and add cows. Over in Europe, they couldn't add cows. So really these companies, and they're almost still all, they are all European based basically, because there they wanted to improve their lifestyle. Right.
Yeah.
So they wanted to cut down on labor. So they started developing these robots. But along with that, their management was so different than here because their margins were so much bigger.
Mm.
And so they were much more focused on, labor and lifestyle. And most of our first robots that went in here, they still are. For smaller farms, it's really more of a lifestyle choice than purely a profitability choice.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. Hi-D from DSM Firmenich optimizes vitamin D levels to increase milk yield, enhance calcium to phosphorus ratio, and strengthen immunity. Exalit, a novel product for the management of hypocalcemia. It's uncomplicated excellence. Adiseo USA, producers of Smartamine M and MilkPay.com. With early detection in health, reproduction, and feeding, SmaxTech future-proofs your dairy operation. Priority IAC, the only company bringing the fields of microbiology and nutrition together. Lalamond Animal Nutrition, partnering in microbial solutions for a changing world. AgriComfort, the cow comfort specialist, because her longevity is your legacy.
All right, everyone, welcome to this episode of the Dairy Podcast Show. I'm today's host, Gail Carpenter, State Dairy Extension Specialist for Iowa State. And I'm joined by one of my colleagues from the University of Minnesota, Jim Salfer. Jim is a regional extension educator at the University of Minnesota. So Jim and I have had the opportunity to work together on a lot of things and really excited to chat with him on today's podcast. Jim, we were talking before we started recording. I wasn't aware of this, that you did your undergrad at South Dakota State. You're just always so like ubiquitous with the University of Minnesota to me, like Jim Salfer, University of Minnesota. They're both kind of the same thing in my head. Right. but you did your undergrad at Minnesota or undergrad at South Dakota, master's at the University of Minnesota, and you've been in your position. According to your LinkedIn, this is your 30th year. Is that right?
Yeah, it's pretty close. That's pretty scary, isn't it? Yeah, Gail, I remember when you were an undergrad. What I remember about you is how willing you were to help out at our state fair workshops. I've chaired state fair workshops for almost as long. And you were so willing to help out. So you're in a good spot with Extension. I mean, you were just...
I love it.
You're really good. Yeah, you were really good with the kids. And
Extension people are so much fun, right? I think that I always love, because we're on the four state committee together, right? So we plan the four state dairy nutrition and management conference with Wisconsin and Illinois.
Yeah.
And then we're also in the I-29 group together with South Dakota State, Nebraska. And I love those working groups because Extension people are just, they're fun to be around. They enjoy helping. They enjoy doing outreach. They love the science. They love best practices and making sure that the industry is thriving. And I don't know. We were talking beforehand about jobs and career, and Extension's just a fun. It's just a great career opportunity, I think, and it's a fun job.
Yeah, I mean, I get that asked question a lot with Mike because I've been in Extension a long time, and before that, I'd done a lot of different jobs for short periods of time. And I always liked Extension. And I think you're right. And I said, I sure must like it because I've done it for a long time and I haven't really looked for another job over this period of time. And as you know, Gail, any kind of academic jobs, you don't go into them for the pay, right? I mean, industry pays more than academics do. I don't think that's a secret to anyone. But I think it's a lot of flexibility. That's one thing I really like about my job. It's just a lot of flexibility of doing different things.
Yeah.
And you're out and about. I think students like, I'm sure you find out too, if you teach any classes, they like Extension because you've got a lot of real life stories.
Yeah.
Because we travel a lot. We get a nice mix of a little bit of research. And obviously you do a lot more research than I do. But get on some farms, So it's kind of fun. And, you know, I coach some children. I know you've coached kids with some of the bowls that you do or some of the work that you do. So, yeah, it's just that's what I probably like a lot is just the diversity. So your foot's in academics, plus your foot's also really in sort of, I'll call it the real world. That's maybe not the right time, but kind of on farm. So, yeah, it's really, that's fun.
Yeah, it's really the land grant ideal, right? That's a, yeah. I think that every university has research. Well, not every university, but most universities have research. Every university has teaching, and the extension is what makes land grant universities kind of special and unique, I think. And it's a pretty neat system.
Yeah, I hope we keep it up. I mean, that's one of the challenges, I think, as universities go through all this structure, because it's one thing to write articles for peer-reviewed journals that only other academics read. But at some point, if that's going to be applied, you need somebody to apply it, right? Somebody to educate the masses, whether that's veterinarians or nutritionists. And of course, they can read journals too. But if you read journals, if you want to fall asleep, find a peer-reviewed journal, crawl in bed with it, and you'll be asleep in 5 minutes. Yep. I mean, it's just their own language, right? You and I both read them, so.
How would you say your job has changed in the last 30 years? I know that we've seen a lot of shifts in extension and even at, like, not just extension, but across universities, there's been a lot of shifting of resources. And how would you say now versus 1995, your position's changed?
It's unbelievable how much it's changed. Because when I started, it was pre-internet.
Oh, yeah.
So it was just starting to come. When I was in maybe 4 or 5 months, then our secretary would get emails. We didn't have any email access. And there wasn't really Google or any of that. So it was real. I would get a packet probably. It was a big envelope, you know, 8x10 or whatever those envelopes are, with kind of press releases from state specialists that I could use and we would write. But the biggest really change is farmers would call me back then and they'd want information. So I would copy things in my files and send them out to them.
Yeah.
And now, of course, farmers have access to basically Google and get the same information. So what's really changed, the biggest change really is they used to come to me for information, barn design, stall design, you know, how to feed cows, they would come to me for information. Now they don't come to me for information. They come to me to sort through good information versus bad information, and how does this apply to me? And so it's really changed from them wanting information, from them saying, which of this information might matter to me, and which is good information and bad information? Because there's information everywhere, as we all know. You know, I can Google anything and find it. Some of it's not very good. So that's the biggest change, really.
That's really interesting that you kind of went to that, because I think our topic for today is robotics, right? And robotic milking systems. And so it's kind of crazy to think that within that 30-year span that we've gone from, even in your career, the no email, no internet, to everything's online, and the computers are even milking our cows for us, right? Like kind of mind-blowing if you think about it.
Yeah, it is really interesting. I've done robot work now since 2009. How we got started in this at Minnesota is we went to a field day in southwest Minnesota, which there aren't many cows for people that might be familiar with it. It was actually my hometown, first robot in the state of Minnesota. And we had 1,500 people there at an open house. And they came from all over the state. And I came back and I started getting questions. They thought, this isn't a fad. We better try and figure this out. So we started with some real basic surveys of going to farms and saying, tell us what works and doesn't work. So that kind of started. But you're right, Gail, my father-in-law, and he grew up milking cows by hand, and he wanted to go to robots so bad. So it's so interesting if you talk to farms with robots, they'll say kids come out and look at the robots and go, okay, these are okay, you know, third, fourth graders. They're used to cell phones and everything. But it's really older people that grew up in that area of, you know, milking cows by hand or with stanchions or whatever they had. I remember looking at the first robots. You could stand there for hours and just go, This is unbelievable.
I know. We used to, so when I was in 4-H in Michigan, we used to go over to do like a judging workout in Canada, and we'd visit a few farms in Southwest Ontario. And part of what we did on that trip is they'd have at the outdoor farm show, they'd have, and they still do this, they have demonstrations of robotic technology. And now they've got feed pushers and they've got milking robots and they've got vectors or feeding systems and all these other cool things, right? But at the time it was like a robot, and it was a old lady, must have been an A1, I suppose.
A1, yeah.
Yep. And yeah, we'd sit and watch it. And I remember Joe Domek, my judging coach, he'd bring a folding chair and he'd just pull out his folding chair and sit down and we'd just stare at that robot. It was just such a...
Yeah, I think this is unbelievable.
I still have the opportunity sometimes with my classes. We actually just went up to Rochester area to visit a robot a couple weeks ago for getting ready for Dairy Challenge. And I had a couple students there who had never seen it before. And I always forget that there are still some students who haven't seen robots, and they're really cool to these people. But for a lot of my students, it's like, oh yeah, like there's a robot that does this thing. It's just like email, right? Yeah. You don't even think about it.
Yep.
Anyway.
Take it for granted. Yep.
Feed formulation software is stuck in the past. Most tools haven't evolved beyond basic least cost optimization. A Diet Forge changes that. It's an AI-powered platform with nonlinear ingredient modeling for enzymes and additives, cost per gain and maximum profit optimization, and real-time collaboration like Google Docs for nutrition. Every recommendation is grounded in world-class research, built for modern nutritionists who need more than legacy desktop software can deliver. Work seamlessly with your team and optimize the way modern operations demand. Try dietforge.ai free today. Feed formulation, finally modernized.
So what shifts have you seen in management? How has our understanding of robotic management evolved since you got into this in 2009? That's getting close to, that's what, 15 years ago now almost. So
yeah, it's really changed a lot. Initially, when robots came in, all the technology or all the information and the knowledge came from Europe.
Because
that's where they started. And Europe's, for listeners that might not know, is for many years, Europe had a quota system, right? A milk quota system. So they were really very profitable at that point. And so they really couldn't increase milk production. Here in the U.S., if we had spare money, if farms were really profitable, we tended to add cows and add cows and add cows. Over in Europe, they couldn't add cows. So really these companies, and they're almost still all, they are all European based basically, because there they wanted to improve their lifestyle. Right.
Yeah.
So they wanted to cut down on labor. So they started developing these robots. But along with that, their management was so different than here because their margins were so much bigger.
Mm.
And so they were much more focused on, labor and lifestyle. And most of our first robots that went in here, they still are. For smaller farms, it's really more of a lifestyle choice than purely a profitability choice. And so what's really changed is, I think, the robot companies and all of us in the industry have learned how to manage robots to really maximize their efficiency, how to maximize milk per robot. You know, we've got some data. There's a number of surveys that have been done over that period of time, and milk per robot continues to go up and up and up. Part of that is barn design. We're getting a lot better at designing barns. You know, some of those early design barns that I go to or the farmers have, you just kind of scratch your head and go, man, what were we thinking when we were doing this? Feeding's gotten a lot better. You know, we used to feed a lot of feed through the robots, a lot more thinking that, well, I mean, there's actually a couple farms we went to at the time, and I was in Europe a couple of years ago, and there's still some farms that feed absolutely no grain in the, all grass silage in the bunk. And there's still actually a farm over in Wisconsin that the farmer moved here from the Netherlands at least a few years ago. He was doing the same thing, and then they'd maybe put feeding stations, and the theory was we're going to feed all this grain out in the buck. We can better precision feed cows. So that always puzzled me initially. I scratched my head and go, didn't we used to do this in our tie stall barns with scoops?
Yes.
I mean, we went to TMRs for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the other thing we've done a lot better job of is minimizing or feeding less pellets through the robot and feeding a lot more in the bunk. And I think that's really helped us get milk production. You know, cows can only eat so fast through the robot, and so they couldn't eat all of their pellets. And so, and I think even our management or our concept of management, initially when we did our first survey, all the discussion was about pellets, pellets, pellets. You know, rightfully so, because that helps cows. That's really changed now, I think. I think it's a lot more focus on getting a really good PMR with really good quality forages and understanding what that you need some sort of feed in the robot to attract them. Although now there's some farms that are feeding zero. But so that feeding and management has kind of changed also.
So if you have a farm that's feeding there, and you alluded to this a little bit, zero to none pellet in the robot, what is pulling the cows up? Is it barn design? What's the secret to getting cows through the robot if you're not enticing?
The barns that are doing that are mostly guided flow barns. The ones that are feeding zero, obviously, are all guided flow barns. But the ones that are feeding a very little, a lot of those are guided flow barns. That's sort of maybe more of a feeding philosophy. They'll maybe feed a pound to 2 pounds just every time a cow comes in. So a fresh cow, she's getting milk 4 times a day. She's probably getting 8 to 10 pounds. You know, whereas if she's getting milk twice a day, she's probably getting maybe 4 pounds of feed. The free flow barns, but they've also cut back. But I think if you look at the research, and that's always been my argument, and again, it's really changed by nutritionists, but typically if our visits weren't very good, we would say, well, I'll just feed more pellets. Way back, Alex Bach, you know, Alex in Spain, did some research, and this was, 10 or 15 years ago. And he went, this was on-farm research, and he showed that more pellets or more robot feed doesn't necessarily make cows come better. I mean, a really good quality feed. So think about yourself. If you're, you know, if you're at Thanksgiving and there's 10 Snickers bars on the table or one, you're just as likely to get up from your couch and go get one Snickers bar as if there's 10 of them there.
Right. So it's kind of I only want one anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think we kind of have this mindset, well, if we give them more pellets, they're more likely to come. Well, not necessarily. You need something really good quality to attract them, but more isn't necessarily better.
That makes sense. You talked about guided flow a little bit. We used to call it forced flow. I guess that's not PC anymore. So do you have, what's your philosophy around the guided versus free flow? I always think this is interesting. I guess I'm not experienced enough to have as strong of an opinion about it as somebody like you would, but I'm always curious to hear people's thoughts about which one kind of works in different systems.
I think, you know, I describe it when I get that question, should I put in a guided flow or free flow? Which is better? I get that question a lot. Which is better, guided flow or free flow?
It depends.
Yeah, I said, well, which is better, grazing or confinement?
Yep.
I said, you need to manage the two systems somewhat differently. You know, in guided flow barns, you obviously have the gates that help can get the cows to the robot, right? So you have gates to assist you. The downside of a guided flow is if they get in that commitment pen, for listeners who might not know what that is, they typically go through now a smart gate, and that smart gate identifies, is it time for her to be milked? And that's usually based on hours and predicted milk production. Okay, if she is, it's not time for her to milk, she gets guided to feed, so she can go through and eat or drink or whatever she's going to do. If it's time for her to be milked, she gets guided into a little pen. Typically, those pens don't have any feed waters or beds in. You don't want them. You want a cow to get in there and get milked.
Yeah.
Well, the challenge with a guided flow system is if you have cows that get in the commitment pen, in theory, they could stand there for 4 or 5 or 6 hours or 10 hours, whatever it is, if they refuse to go through the robot. So they could be stuck in that commitment pen. And that's been the criticism of the people that really talk about free flow barns, right? But the disadvantage, but the advantage of that is I think you can kind of, you got those gates to help you get cows milked when they need to be milked, but they really need to be trained on those gates. So I think training of fresh animals is much more important. And some people will argue, well, if I do a poor job of management in a guided flow barn, it hurts the cows. That is true. You know, now there's apps on your phone that tell you how much this cow number one has been in the commitment pen 2 or 3 hours. You just got to figure out how to deal those cows that might be stuck in a commitment pen.
Yeah.
But feeding is much less important in a guided flow barn because you've got those gates to help you. In a free flow barn, obviously the advantage is cows can do whatever they want anytime, but you're going to have more fetch cows. And fetch cows, again, are cows that you need to catch and get to the robot because you don't have the gates to help you. So it's you really need to think about how you want to manage your barn and your management. But both of them, I mean, it's interesting. One of our surveys we did, this was maybe, I don't know, 4, 5, 6, 7 years ago. We compared and we had, I don't know, we had 10 or 15 free flow barns. And I think we had about 30 free flow barns. I think we had 10 or 15. When you just did raw averages of milk production, they were within a half a pound of each other, milk per cow per day. One was like 89 and a half and one was 89. So they both can work as long as you manage them. And I think we've gotten a lot better at barn design for both of them.
Yeah. Do you, how much do you think about milk per cow versus milk per robot?
You know, that's a really good question. You know, the discussion is always milk per, and they're very correlated, right?
Right.
I mean, when we've done some of our statistics, the same factors that affect milk per cow affect milk per robot. I like high production, and so I'll fetch cows, but I think the robot companies or the lenders may look more at milk per robot, but milk per cow drives milk per robot where it may not. And I get the question a lot about how many cows per robot should you have? Yeah, I think that's a really good question. There are some farms, we have one farm in Minnesota I know pretty well, that they run close to 80 cows per robot.
Oh, wow.
Too many. They'll admit it's probably too many. I don't want to sell cows. They spend a lot of time fetching cows, as you can imagine, because there's just not enough time.
Yeah.
So if you want to, you're going to have more fetch cows. You're going to spend more time in the barn. So if you've got, there's another farm that runs a lot of free time. Listen, free time is, or idle time, sometimes it's called. It's time where the robots aren't milking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're not always there and you don't have the skill to always repair your robots or your large crop farmers, there's a pretty large crop farmer that runs a lot of free time, 50 cows per robot. And he said, I don't have time during harvest to stop. And I've got my cows. My cows have got to go through. I can't have fetch cows. I'm just too busy because he farms several thousand acres of land. So again, I think both of them are really important. I think lenders really focus at milk per cow or milk per robot. But I think it's a balance of what's the right number. I think that's really the number. It's a balance because as you decrease cows per robot, milkings per cow go up, so you get more milk per cow. But milk per cow, you know, 3 cows per robot isn't going to pay your robot bill.
Right.
So I think it's really a balance. And I get a lot of farmers have really opinions what the right number is there. When I get this question, I'll say, you know, I can just tell you there's farms that average 2.7, 2.8 milkings per cow that average over 100 pounds per day. The key is getting the right cows milked at the right time, right? I mean, that's what you want to do.
Elevate animal performance with Bergenschmidt Animal Nutrition, your trusted ally in excellence. Their high-quality feed ingredients like coated nutrients and fat powders provide ruminants with extra energy, boosting health, productivity, and cost efficiency. Unleash your herd's potential with Bergenschmidt. The next giant leap in dairy profitability is here. Introducing AffiColor Feed Efficiency Service from AffiMilk, the first sensor to accurately measure individual cow dry matter intake. Combine individual feed consumption with milk production data to get profitability insights never before available. Hear from producers who are using it to make a big impact on profitability and sustainability at AffiMilk.com.
When we talk about barn design and deciding what works for your farm, that must be a very hard conversation to have because you don't know your management style when it comes to robots if you don't have experience doing robots. And it's a big investment, right?
Yes.
And you might be retrofitting your barn or building a new facility on top of the cost of the robot itself. So that that can be, I imagine, pretty difficult to navigate when you're trying to think through what you think might work for you and then making the investment and then troubleshooting afterwards to find out what actually does work for you.
Yeah.
I guess that's not a question. That's just...
No, you're right, Gail. No, that's exactly. I'm having this conversation now with somebody that's looking at building robots and guided flow or free flow. And then do I want, I mean, these are all the questions, right? Because as you said, it's a big investment. Almost everybody putting in robot farms have never managed robots.
Right.
And
right.
So it's, do I want a sort pen or not? You know, they add some to the cost. And so do I want headlocks? That's one of the decisions on this farm. You know, I said, well, you know, how do you want to manage your cows? Well, I don't know. I said, so when the vet comes, do you want headlocks where they're all locked up? And he talks to different farmers and some will say, oh, I wouldn't manage without headlocks.
Right.
Other ones will say, I put in headlocks and I hardly use them.
Yep.
You know, so yep. It is it's really hard. You kind of keep prompting the farmer and saying, well, these are the pros and cons of headlocks. These are the pros and cons of sort gates or sort pens. I did actually a little model we did. We have some stretchy models. And one thing I think about people, and I've got it popped up here so I can look at, if you can save 15 minutes of labor, this is 250 cows, four robots, 3% wage inflation. If you can save 15 minutes per robot per day and get similar milk production. So I've got, so one I've got sort gates in and one I don't. For an example, I'm going to say 15 minutes. You make $5,532 more dollars per year, which means you can pay for $150,000 of additional barn investment. So I try to talk to people a little bit about that when they say, I can't afford to put in sort gates. And I said, well, if you save a little bit of money over 20 years,
right,
then you can. But you also have to have the money to do it. So I'm also sensitive to people that say, I just can't get the money. But I think that's one way to kind of think about these labor-saving devices is, you know, they're, as you said, this is a really sort of semi-permanent decision. You can always remodel anything, right, if you knock out enough concrete. But that's, you know, you'd kind of walk people through it. But you're exactly right, Gail. It's a tough decision.
I'm glad you mentioned the tools, right? I know University of Minnesota Extension has done a lot when it comes to robots. Do you want to talk to our listeners a little bit about what tools you have available? And you guys got a YouTube channel and some other cool things online. Do you want to pitch some of that?
Yeah, we do have a YouTube channel. For a couple of years, Marcy Endres, a colleague of mine, and these are all farmers. I mean, this was kind of on purpose. We wanted to just do webinars with farmers are half hour long, so they're not very long. And we just said, kind of tell us your best management practices. And we've got guided flow, free flow, kind of every brand. These are from throughout the United States, very different size farms. So you can go to YouTube and probably 30-minute robot discussion or something we have. We had a title. We also have, you probably have to email me this. I don't know if it's still up online. We have a spreadsheet model that does some of this, and it does cash flows and stuff, but I don't think that's the use of it. Where I think it's pretty useful is do some of these quick and dirty cuts. So if I get 5 pounds of milk more per cow per day, what does my profitability look like? If I get 10 more pounds of milk per day, what does my profitability look like? Gail, this is a good question I get from you. How much more milk should you get per cow per day when you put in robots?
It depends.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you're right.
I guess it probably depends on what your current is. Are you going from a 2X milking and a tie stall and retrofitting that to a robot? Like what do you tell people when they ask you that question?
Exactly the same thing you say, Gail. I said, you know, and the challenge is, I think, a little bit, the robot companies initially had this discussion. I was debating what we should be using for some of this. And he said, oh, 20 pounds. I said, you got to be crazy.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he was a good salesman. And I said, you know, going from 2 to 2.57 times average milking, you're not going to get 20 pounds. To me, I think about three things that affects. And my models, I usually use five, Because the best data I could find, kind of going from 2 to 2.7, was 5, 6, 7 pounds of milk in there. But I think I really underestimated, Gail, for our small farms, how much labor sparing, I call it a labor sparing effect. So now they get stuff done that they didn't get done. So if a farm says, I think I can get 10, I said, yeah, I think if you structure your labor right, I think you can get 10. But so now they get their hay cut on time, right? Then they get it harvested on time and they get their heifers bred on time. So I think I underestimated, I shouldn't. I grew up on a farm, right? Well, you know, farms are like, they're busy all the time. There's never enough hours in a day. Mm-hmm. But I think I maybe underestimated how big of an effect that had. The other thing is the barn effect. As you said, Gail, if, you know, with these guys, there are people who get 20 more pounds, but they're going from tie stall barns with little skinny rubber mats to a sand bedded freestall barn. Well, how much is the barn worth, right?
Right.
You're probably
right.
Getting 10 pounds of that because you're in a sand bedded freestall barn.
It's probably really complicated to tease apart a lot of these things. And some of the things you mentioned, like, okay, my preg rate's improved, so my days in milk are down, or my heifers are getting bred on time, like all of these other things, they're not something you're going to see in a month, right? They're something you're going to see after a couple years on this. So it's not necessarily an overnight thing.
No, we did a survey, kind of interesting. This was with Wisconsin, and we asked farmers before and after. So it's not very scientific, right? I mean, there's a lot of factors that go in there. And maybe not surprising, but actually farms that were a little lower in milk production to start off went up more, they're, you know, a year or two into robots than herds that were really high. So if you were averaging 90 pounds of milk before robots, you didn't go up as much. And I think part of that is just because they maybe had reproduction right, so they didn't need the same. They also had maybe a really comfortable barn. So for other listeners out there, at least that's what our survey showed, that if you were 60, 70, really good manager, maybe a poor barn, you're likely to go up a lot in milk production. If you're doing everything right now with a really comfortable barn, you're probably going to get more milk, but not as much.
Okay, we're kind of coming up towards time, but here's a question I'd like to end on. Is there any deal breakers when you're working with producers who think they want to put in robots? Is there anything that to you is a big red flag and you're like, robots are not the thing for you?
Yeah, I think, and this was actually a farmer who told me this. He said, if you really like machinery and your goal of putting in robots is to drive by your barn in the morning in your new tractor and say, hi, cows, have a good day, and then drive back at night, hi, cows, it's nice to see you again. The best robot farms are people that still really, really like cows. They just don't necessarily like milking them. So I think if your goal is to just milk cows, but you really don't like cows, the people that are by far the most successful is people that are fascinated with cow behavior and really like cows. They're likely to be really successful. I think not that other people can't be successful, but they're likely to be frustrated because their cows aren't going to do well. I mean, they're not going to get the results. So I think that's something you kind of need to look in the mirror and say, do I really, really like cows and just want help milking them?
All right. Well, I said that was the last question, but maybe one more.
Okay.
Just to kind of close up, like I mentioned, you and I are both involved in some of these extension groups. We're specifically the 4-state group and I-29. And I think we do some pretty cool programs. So would you like to take it a minute and pitch some of the programs that we have coming up with I-29 and with 4-State?
Sure, yeah. I mean, the 4-State program, our big program, is a nutrition conference. You know, we always debate and talk. There used to be, for people that remember, there used to be a number of different 4-State programs. But really now it's a nutrition conference that we're actually going to move to La Crosse. It's been in Dubuque, Iowa for quite a number of years. But that's been a really good program, again, mostly targeted at nutritionists. For I-29, we do webinars and podcasts. It's really carried by the Iowa group, right? Fred Hall, your colleague,
Fred's
and my colleague in
that.
Northwest
yes.
Iowa, does a really good job with that. So we do some podcasts. We do some webinars. We do probably one of the premier dairy beef conferences in the country that's associated with Central Plains. So if you have any interest, interesting enough, we originally started this targeting dairy farmers. And it really, we haven't got a lot of dairy farmers, maybe because a lot of them don't finish, but it's a really good conference, I'll say, but it's during Central, kind of the day before Central Plains. And then we do, you know, we do a few other kind of random activities, some 4-H meetings. What else do we do, Gail? I mean, you're really involved with those groups.
Those are the big ones. The Dairy Beef Short Course, I think, is that's been a really cool project to be a part of.
Yeah, you're speaking, Gail, so I'll put in a plug.
Yeah.
If you want to come and hear some of Gail's latest research, she's going to be
speaking.
Yeah,
we're going to talk about some of the research that we've been doing here at Iowa State. So I'm going to talk about the pre-weaning stuff, and then one of my colleagues on the beef side is going to talk about the finishing data. We've got some dairy faculty coming up. We've got Jennifer Spencer coming up from Texas to talk about vaccinations. We're going to talk about lameness and some health issues. So I do think it's always interesting that we don't get more dairy producers, because being associated with Central Plains, it seems like, just come a day early. It's Sioux Falls. So why wouldn't you want to come a day early to Sioux Falls and and spend some extra time in South Dakota and do some cool discussions about dairy beef.
Yeah, and we've had some kind of dairy topics. I know, and you know, we don't have it this year, but kind of genetics, what breeds you should be using. And last year we had a guy that looked at that, kind of basically how well do these calves sell. And so I think we've really tried to have topics that would pertain to dairy farmers. But as you mentioned, for whatever reason, it just doesn't seem like we get some, but not a lot.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if that changed over the next couple of years with as profitable as these beef crosses have turned out to be for a lot of dairy farms. I think it does seem like there's a growing interest in it as an income source.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's a lot more interest in our farmers maybe finishing or at least holding them till they're a little bit bigger. I don't know what the right answer is for that is, but I think especially some of our smaller farms, they're trying to figure out how to grow their income, you know, like everybody else.
All right. Well, I better wrap us up so we can get to the three questions that all of our guests get asked. Before I do, you mentioned that folks can email you for information. Do you want to just drop your email address real quick so that folks know where they can find you?
Sure. S-A is an apple, L-F-E-001. And then at UMN, as in University of Minnesota, umn.edu. So SALFE001.
The first sulfur.
Yes. I can tell. I started when there was no email, right?
Yep.
So I was the only one.
When I was at Minnesota, my email was CARPE, C-A-R-P-E, and it was 370. So must have been a lot of carpenters.
Yeah.
It's time for our famous three. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Jones Hamilton is proud to support this episode and support healthier environments with our pH control product, Surface. Surface controls ammonia, improves air quality, and supports hoof health to create healthier spaces for calves, cows, and the people who care for them. Backed by decades of experience in animal agriculture, Jones Hamilton helps producers leverage the power of pH to support herd health, welfare, and productivity. Learn more at JonesHamiltonAg.com. Natural Biologics delivers cost-effective solutions to improve health and productivity, helping conquer the rumen health and immunity challenges your animals face. Your partner for extra animal performance, Berg & Schmidt Animal Nutrition. More milk and higher conception rates, contact AHV to take uterine health to the next level. Accurately measure individual cow feed efficiency with the newest advancement from AffiMilk. Visit AffiMilk.com to learn more. That's AffiMilk.com. Evonik Animal Nutrition, sciencing the global food challenges. Cow Manager, ahead of the herd together. Jones Hamilton is proud to support this episode and support healthier environments with our pH control product, Surface. Surface controls ammonia, improves air quality, and supports hoof health to create healthier spaces for calves, cows, and the people who care for them. Backed by decades of experience in animal agriculture, Jones Hamilton helps producers leverage the power of pH to support herd health, welfare, and productivity. Learn more at JonesHamiltonAg.com.
All right. right, let's go ahead. Three questions that all of our guests get asked. The first one is, what is your favorite dairy-related book or resource?
You know, I don't know. I still really like Hordes Dairymen. I think they do a really nice job of, you know, it's just an interesting magazine with a lot of good editorials. They've got a little bit of marketing information in there. Other than that, all the online kind of stuff we use, you know, I suppose I should be saying Journal of Dairy Science or something a little more scientific. But I still think Hordes is probably as good a magazine that there is out there really for dairy, real practical kind of dairy stuff.
All right. So second question is, what is your favorite non-dairy related book or resource? We were talking beforehand about you really like reading nonfiction. So
and most of my nonfiction books are actually about behavior, human behavior, or strategic planning. The other thing I really like, if you want a specific resource, Harvard Business Review.
Oh, yeah.
It has nothing to do with dairy, as you can imagine, coming from Harvard. But if you want, and they do have kind of a free, you know, you can get some of their resources free. Of course, they like a paid subscription. But I think that that's a really interesting resource.
Very good.
You know, it's interesting. Do you have a minute here? Because there was something a couple of years ago from Harvard Business Review that said the headlines were "Milk is too cheap." And it was really interesting. And again, author knows nothing about milk. But his argument was, is the dairy industry has not been able to innovate because they've raced to the bottom. Their goal is to be the cheapest product. And he argued, you've got a great product. It's very nutritious. But with no margins, no companies can innovate. He said the companies, he said, look at the pop companies, all the stuff they can make, partly because their margins are so big. It's carbonated water and flavor in a can.
Right. Yeah.
And it was really interesting. But his argument, the dairy industry has really made a major mistake by really promoting great nutrition at a cheap price. He said, you need to raise your prices so you can really innovate with new products. That was one of the more interesting ones I ever read because it was about the dairy industry. And I thought, you know, there's some truth in that. We go and brag about how, and it's good to have reasonably priced products, right? But he argues, and he was talking to the general audience, you can underprice things and make them too cheap. Because then you don't have any margin to innovate. That was really his moral of his story. You need margin to innovate.
That's really fascinating.
Yeah.
Harvard
Business Review. Interesting.
Yeah. All right. Our last question is, what do you think sets successful dairy professionals apart from those that are not successful?
You know, that's a really good question, Gail. I think we're getting really good at management. And so I think the farms that are setting themselves apart are the ones that are doing a little more, they know business acumen, you know, kind of intuitively, and they really understand the business side of it. And what I mean by that is they make investments that are going to make them more money in the future. They don't, I hope I'm not criticizing anybody here, but they don't wait till they do their tax estimates and say, man, I made a lot of money. I need to spend money. So they walk across the street to the Ford dealer and buy a new $70,000 pickup. They kind of have a capital list. And so they really have the ability to think about what is my next good investment that's going to make me more money, whatever that might be. And I think the other ones that really think about the changes in the industry. So kind of the strategic planning, you were talking about being on a strategic planning committee, kind of thinking about where do I want my business to be in the future? Tell farmers, what are your human strengths? So your skills and what are your natural resource strengths? And capitalize on those because that's how you become better at, that's how you get a competitive advantage. So I think the ones that are constantly thinking about their competitive advantage, but at the same time, you need to be good at all the day-to-day management. It's just that most people are good at that, right? Or they're not in business anymore.
Yeah. I don't know when this episode's going to drop, but when we're recording, it is right at the turn of the new year. And so I've been seeing a lot of stuff about, you know, goal setting and resolutions. And I think a common theme that I've seen in a lot of places is focus not on trying to fix yourself, right? Don't focus on what you do poorly and think I need to be like improve this thing that I'm just not good at, but focus on the things that make you unique and make you like are your strengths. Like you said, what are something that you're good at that you can contribute, that you can continue to grow in? And I think we're just naturally more inclined to actually improve in those things if we already are passionate about them and excited about them and good at them. So,
yeah. Have you done Strength Finders?
I have. Yes.
Yeah. And isn't that sort of the theory of that book? You know, I think for a while, the theory on management was find your weaknesses and work on them, right?
Yeah.
And I think they've discovered, or management gurus, not me, discovered that people just get frustrated.
Yeah.
If there's things you're really not good at, and people are saying you have to be good at it, we just get frustrated. Most of our passions are around things we're good at, and we like to do. So why not really accentuate those?
Do you know what your top five strengths are?
I can't remember. I know you have them on your, yeah, I think I saw them on your, is it your email tag?
I got them in my email signature, yeah.
Signature, yeah.
Yep.
So what are they? Can you rattle them off?
Yeah, I'm positivity, developer, self-assurance, harmony, maximizer.
Oh.
And maximizer, that's my number five. Maximizer is all about like making the best better. Kind of like 4-H, right? Like,
yeah, that's good, a 4-H model.
Being good at what you're good at, yeah. So, well, we are over time, so probably a better bring this discussion to a conclusion. But always great to talk to you, Jim. Always great to chat and never run out of things to talk about. So thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Gail. Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.